This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com. Good morning. It is Sunday, June 10th. It's been a while since we've done this. Had a week off and had Shavuos in the middle. We're up to class number 3, I think, on the series on the halachic process. I think it's 3. And today I wanted to start off with a class on the basis for rabbinic authority. Starting from here on out, we're going to, you know, we spent the first few weeks discussing about biblical sources and law and covenant and, like, the legal system. We discussed Kelson. We'll quote a little bit more from him from another book. But now we're getting into, you know, almost the real meat of the halachic process because, you know, God gives us the Torah, but everything else that, you know, happens sort of afterwards is the result of, you know, men and people. We'll talk a little bit about that, too. And all of that is going to need to be justified. So today, we're going to start off with a basis for rabbinic authority and spend a lot of time expanding on, you know, details of the rabbinic authority. I think next week we're going to talk about what exactly is a rabbi. How did the smicha thing work? And then we can go through, well, now that we've established that rabbis, or at least a certain group or cadre of rabbis have certain authority, what was the legal system that they set up, and how do we go about extrapolating? As I've said here a few times, like even before you get to studying Gemara, you need to sort of, you know, justify its existence in some way. So we're going to, you know, almost cheat a little today because we are going to quote some Gemaras before we have it straight, but it at least gives us a few different perspectives behind it. So again, we're sticking with the core premise that, you know, the divinity of the Torah, that the Torah is a representation of divine will. The focus today is, you know, what the basis for rabbinic authority and the challenges that we're going to try to face and keep in the back of our heads, the sources of authority, validations of certain individuals, and how do you handle disputes and disagreements? Right, which I think are valid questions too, because this really, you know, gets to the heart of what authority is. We did a midrash on Friday night from Bemidbar Rabba that says, you know, if someone gets up and says, well, you know, this rabbi says this, that rabbi says that, someone says mutzer, someone says aser, someone says tame, someone says tor, someone says pure, someone says isn't pure, what am I supposed to do? And the midrash says, well, no, that they all came from the same shepherd. I mean, they all came from the same source. It doesn't actually answer the question so much, but there's that acknowledgement that, you know, even the rabbinic period, people argue endlessly over lots of stuff. But let's start, you know, at the very beginning with the distinction between natural law and positive law. This is Hans Kelsen, General Theory of Law and State. Ed, go ahead.
The will of God is, in the natural law doctrine, identical with nature, insofar as nature is conceived of as created by God. And the laws of nature is expressing God's will. Consequently, the laws determining nature have, according to this doctrine, the same character as the legal rules issued by a legislator. They have
natural law.
They are
natural law according to its. Well, no, I'm sorry, you skipped a line there.
Just
they are commands directed to nature. And nature obeys these commands, the laws of nature, these commands come with the laws of nature, just as man obeys the laws issued by a legislator.
Natural law, according to its specific doctrine, is not created by the act of human will. It is not the artificial, arbitrary product of man. It can be and has to be deduced from nature by a mental operation.
All right, so stop there. Can you read on, you know, separate, but ultimately, he has this line, and so far as nature manifests God's will, these rights and duties are sacred. So, you know, there's something called natural law theory, which is described by, you know, Kelsen here. You've got God that creates the world in nature, and, you know, all of God's rules, morals, ethics, and stuff, or, and rights and duties, as he puts it here, are reflective of the will of God. The Jewish system, if you want to say there's something called natural law, it's that what it is in the Torah, because instead of trying to intuit from the world around you, what does God want, have a book that says, God says, I want this. All right. Dana, take the next part from 114.
law is always positive law, and its positivity lies in the fact that it is created and annulled by acts of human beings, thus being independent of morality and similar norm systems.
Yeah. So the real difference here between, as he describes it, between natural law and positive law is that, you know, the morality from, you know, natural law, you just think of it, what's the will of nature, whereas from a legal perspective, it's a matter of reason. And the other core distinction is, on one hand, you've got what God wants, but on the other hand, positive law is what men say, right? So that's going to be a very important dichotomy. So let's go back to some biblical sources, because again, if we're going to, if we're going to justify the authority of rabbis or sages, authority has to come from someplace, right? It's bestowed. Like people can, assume authority through might, right? Listen to me or I will kill you, right? That's one, source of authority. That's, not necessarily the most ethical of legal systems, mind you, but it is a source of authority, or just the pure submission. So what are the real origins of rabbinic or, and I put a slash here, judicial authority? I do take, this is Exodus Shmot 18:13-27.
The next day, Moses took his seat to serve as judge for the people, and they stood around him from morning till evening. When his father-in-law saw all that Moses was doing for the people, he said, "What is this you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge while all those people stand around you from morning till evening?" Moses answered him, "Because the people come to me to seek God's will. Whenever they have a dispute, it is brought to me, and I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and instructions." Moses' father-in-law replied, "What you are doing is not good. You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone. Listen now to me, and I will give you some advice, and may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to him. Teach them his decrees and instructions, and show them the way they are to live and how they are to behave. But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times, but have them bring every difficult case to you. The simple cases they can decide themselves. That will make your load lighter, because they will share it with you. If you do this, and God so commands, you will be able to stand the strain, and all these people will go home satisfied." Moses listened to his father-in-law and did everything he said. He chose capable men from all Israel and made them leaders of the people, officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. They served as judges for the people at all times. The difficult cases they brought to Moses, but the simple ones they decided themselves. Then Moses sent his father-in-law on his way, and Jethro returned to his own country.
Yeah. People may remember this. I mean, it's a matter to, chronologically here. This passage occurs before Matan Torah. And I believe Yeshayahu Leibowitz is one who says that, uses this as a proof text for the oral law. Because otherwise, how can Moshe be judging based on God's will if God didn't actually have that whole revelation thing? But at any rate, the first judge is here, right? So Moshe is sitting and judging. Yitro has this idea, hey, wait a second, this is a really inefficient system. Teach other people what to do, and they can take a little bit of the load off of you. And if there's something that, then just work up, the ladder. Yeah.
Well, we're actually missing a key phrase. And I don't know that something this important should be understood. There's nothing here that says teach the people what to do. It gives you the criteria for what kind of people they should be.
Well, you're teaching there are different types of teaching. I mean, if you have a question, you come to me with a question, I give you an answer,
yes.
I'm teaching you.
Yes,
That's one level of teaching.
Yes.
Another level of teaching is me teaching other people how to teach.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I think that's more of what's going on here. Meaning, Moshe, if I want to set up people who are going to be my representatives, then I just don't give, I have to give them information, obviously, but what you give, you know, by way of information of how to, you know, give the instructions, you need a very different approach. Here's the difference. Like, there's l'ilmod al-manat la'asot and l'ilmod al-manat l'lamed. You've got learning in order to do and learning in order to teach. Now, in theory, like, you're just learning Torah, but there are also very different skills. If just because I know what to do, how I impart that to other people might not necessarily work. There are different skills involved there.
Even so, there's nothing in the text explicitly that said these people knew what to do, and teaching them how to judge versus giving them all the backstory knowledge.
Well, that's what, you know, you're actually...
I don't see anywhere where these people went to school. I don't see anywhere where...
Verse 20. Vizhartem etem et hachukim et torot. Right? Teach them the laws and this Torah. Vahodat alehem et derech yeluchuba vet maser sheyasun. And show them the decrees and the instructions and show them the way they are to live and how to behave. That's your schooling right there.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
Can I ask?
Sure.
There seems to be a missing link here.
Yeah.
A person comes to Moses with before he sets up the judges.
Yeah.
A person comes to Moses with a problem, presumably because it was never stated explicitly by God anywhere.
Oh, there could be lots of reasons. Well, you could have lots of reasons to have a problem.
And then Moses will tell them what God wants.
Yeah.
How does Moses know what God wants?
Well, he's a prophet.
And then take it one step further.
Yeah.
How do the judges know what God wants?
Well, so one of the assumptions here, and it's an excellent assumption, is that Moshe, you know, at this point, you know, has a certain degree of prophecy, right? Or can have some communication with God. Again, you know, following, all right, so you can look at it two ways. Like, let's say you assume that this is a template that also, you know, takes effect, and we'll see Deuteronomy 1:8 through 18. Actually, you know what, let's do that now, and we'll combine the two. There's, when Moshe in Sefer Devarim is sort of giving a retelling of things, he does a little bit of, you know, almost revisionist history compared to the source from Shmot. Had actually a nice drush on this a couple of years ago. But for the sake of this particular class, know that there are a few differences here. So here's how he describes it. At that time, I said to you, you are too heavy a burden for me to carry alone. The Lord your God has increased your numbers so that today you are as numerous as the stars in the sky. May the Lord, Lord, the God of your ancestors, increase you 1,000 times and bless you as he had promised. But how can I bear your problems and burdens and your disputes all by myself? Choose some wise, understanding, and respected men from each of your tribes, and I will set them over you. You answered me, what you proposed to do is good. So I took the leading men of your tribes, wise, respected men, and appointed them to have authority over you as commanders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, of tens, and tribal officials. And I charged your judges at that time, saying, hear the disputes between your people and judge fairly, whether the case between two Israelites or Israelites and a foreigner residing among you. Do not show partiality in judging. Hear both great and small alike. Do not be afraid of anyone, for judgment belongs to God. Bring any case too hard for you, and I will hear it. At that time I told you everything you were going to do. Now, you'll notice there are a whole bunch of distinctions here between how it's described in Shmot and how it's described in Devarim, right? For one, right, Moshe here is passing it off as his own idea as opposed to Yitro. That's a pretty big deal there, too. Two, selection of the judges, right? Selection of the judges in Shmot, Moshe seems to be the one who's doing the selecting. In Devarim, he's asking the people to do the selecting. There are also, you know, some other subtle differences in the description about the qualifications of a judge.
How long after my time Torah does this take place?
Give or take 40 years. And the second one here in Dvarim is, you know, this is at the end of Moshe's life after, you know, the whole, yeah, after that whole, you know. So the truth is, you know, one of the ways I explain the differences is that he's speaking to a new generation and he's trying to give them sort of a different approach to the judicial system that's going to be necessary for a new generation that's entering the land of Israel. But it is, you know, there's some fascinating distinctions between the two. At the end, you've got a system where Moshe, right, certainly at this point, it's after Matan Torah, right? So he was the one who received the Torah. What did Moshe do? Moshe received the Torah, and then he spoke to the Jewish people, right? All right, pretty simple, right? So he then can now tell other people, oh, here are a bunch of details, now you go ahead and start teaching more of, like, the Jewish people. So at this point, you've got a judicial system, you know, kind of set up that might have originated from the top down, right? Moshe, you know, receiving it from God, but now he's transmitting it to other people. And if there are any questions, it, you know, works its way back up the ladder. All right, from just a matter of appeals. But the reason why it was set up this way was a diffusion of responsibility, because you can't have one person handling, you know, small claims like so-and-so owes me, you know, $5. Right, I'm not going to go to President Obama and say, or unless I'm a celebrity, I can tweet, you know, President Obama, you know, fix this drunk driving thing for me, as someone did this past week. Yeah, I doubt the president is going to intervene, but you get the point. At any rate, the first judicial system set up, right, in the desert again, Moshe sets it up, depending on how you read it, but, you know, Moshe sets it up, and you've got lower people who are helping him out in the process. Yes.
All Torah is now passed on to the judges?
So that's kind of how, well, that's kind of how I know certain people, like you mentioned, Yishai Leibowitz, explain this, where, you know, we pass down not just, you know, because he gave the laws over to the Jewish people, and he said a lot of things he said in public. But as we know, there are a whole lot of details, you know, that just never made it in. So, like, here's one example that I know some books like proving, you know, like demonstrating about, you know, proving there's some oral tradition, things like Shechita, right? So, you know, we're told that you're supposed to, you know, have some sort of, you know, ritual slaughter there, but you have no details in the Torah itself. What is Shechita, right? So God wants you to do something but doesn't tell you how. Like, it's kind of weird. So there's an assumption, well, where you don't have all of those things fleshed out, is like specifically, there's an oral transmission there. We'll get to that a little bit later in this class about, you know, the oral transmission stuff. But at any rate, those are, you know, the first judges. Ed, take us to section B here, which describes more of the permanent established judicial system.
Appoint judges and officials for each of your tribes in every town the Lord your God is giving you, and they shall judge the people fairly. Do not pervert justice or show partiality. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the innocent. Follow justice and justice alone, so that you may live and possess the land the Lord your God has given you.
All right, so this, when they're about to enter Israel, he's giving them a commandment, set up local courts by wherever city you happen to be. George, take number 5. This is Deuteronomy 17, 8 through 13.
People will bring their cases to your courts, but some cases will be too hard for you to judge. They might be about murders, attacks, or other crimes. Then take these hard cases to the place the Lord your God will choose. Go to a priest who is a Levite, and go to the judge who is in office at the time. Ask them for their decision. They will give it to you. They will hand down their decisions at the place the Lord will choose. You must do what they decide. Be careful to do everything they direct you to do. Act in keeping with the laws they teach you. Accept the decisions they give you. Don't turn away from what they will tell you. Don't turn to the right or to the left. Some might willfully ignore the judge, or he might act presumptuously regarding the priest who serves the Lord your God at the place where he will choose. If a man does that, he must be put to death. Remove that evil person from Israel. All of the people of Israel will hear about it, and they will be afraid to act presumptuously regarding the judge or the priest again.
So here, you've got God saying, well, go to, I mean, notice here, it's first go to the priest, who is a Levite, right? Vata elakoyim halagim, ela shofeta shebimi mahein. Or to the judges, who are in office at that time, you have to ask them, right? These judges and the priest are supposed to examine it, tell you what to do, and you are not allowed to deviate. Right? That is, right, in biblical law, the system of how things are going to work. So the main things here, you've got two real components here of the Supreme Court. In addition to the shoftim v'shotrim, you're supposed to set up local courts and local officers by the towns where you live. You're also setting up here a national court. If there's something, kipale mimacha davar, if something is beyond your understanding, you have to set up a real central court. Right? So you're talking about the people, you've got kohanim, priests who are part of this process, shofet, at least one judge, and there's a matter of place. There's asher yabayamim ahem. There's something in terms of a matter of time, right? And there's a midrash that says you might think that could you go to a judge who is not in your times? It's like, no, you go to whichever judge happens to be there. But it's also ba'alit al makom sheyivchar. But it's also going up to that place where God will choose. Meaning there seems to be something here in the Pasuk specifically about this the place, the geography of authority. Right? And it's part of it, the makom itself helps provide a certain degree of justification for the authority, because this is the place where God chose and that's where you're supposed to sit. Yeah.
There's no accommodation here for the possibility of human error.
Not yet, and we're going to get to that in the next section here. Right, but I first wanted to lay the groundwork for biblical sources for the human element in the halachic process. So you have Moshe that set one up initially. You have a commandment to set up things locally and a commandment to set things up nationally, or at least in one central location. Right? Note that it also uses that term shofet in the singular, not shofetim.
It also seems to say that priests will be in various places.
Priests were going to be in various places, but more importantly, you knew that priests were going to be at the Makom Asher Yivchar, because the priests were going to have to serve in whatever edifice was going to be at that place. So you knew priests were going to be there, but yeah, you did have priests all over.
But the assumptions are going to be in Israel, and they're going to be the Mishkan, or the building of the first temple.
Yeah.
Where were weren't all the priests in the temple?
No, not all the priests were at the temple. Most of them probably were.
What purpose did they serve outside?
I can teach, do other stuff, whatever Kohanim do.
the cities of refuge.
Yeah. All right. Don't forget, you had Nov, you're a Kohanim in Navi, too. So you even had a city full of them. Although it didn't end well. Anyway, let's move on to the next section here. So now that we've set up, getting your point here, Divine Law in Human Hands, which is the name of a wonderful collection of essays by, I'm looking those off. I think it's Jacob Katz. I can't get this computer, these are Katz or Bach. Ah, sorry, my head's leaving. I think it's Jacob Katz. Anyway, Divine Law in Human Hands. So now that we have some biblical setup, what are some bases that the rabbis give for their own authority? So here's one approach, and this is retrieval from Sinai. Where are we up to? So take Mishnah Abba 1:1.
Moses received the Torah from Sinai and transmitted it to Joshua. Joshua to the elders to the prophets, and the prophets handed it down to the men of the great assembly. They said three things: be deliberate in judgment, raise up many disciples, and make a fence around the Torah.
All right, so let's hold off on, whole fence thing. The first, main point here is you've got, this first mission of Pirkei Avot, the chain of transmission. And it begins with Moshe receiving it from Sinai, and then working its way on down the line. Similarly, you've got a Gemara in Erevin 54b. Our rabbis learned, what was the procedure of instruction in the oral law? Moses learned from the mouth of the Omnipotent. Then Aaron entered and Moses taught him his lesson. Aaron then moved aside and sat down on Moses' left. Thereupon Aaron's sons moved in and entered, and Moses taught them their lesson. His sons moved aside, Eleazar taking a seat on Moses' right, and Itamar on Aaron's left. Rav Yehuda said it, Aaron was always on Moses' right. Thereupon the elders entered, and Moses taught them their lesson. When the elders moved aside, all the people entered, and Moses taught them their lesson. It thus followed that Aaron heard the lessons 4 times, his sons heard it 3 times, the elders 2 times, and the people 1 time. At this stage, Moses departed, and Aaron taught them his lesson. Then Aaron departed, and the sons taught them their lesson. The sons departed, and the elders taught them their lesson. Thus it followed, everyone heard the lesson 4 times. From here, Rabbi Eliezer inferred, it is a man's duty to teach his pupil his lesson 4 times. For this has arrived at Kal Vachomer. Aaron, who learned it from Moses, had the or had heard from the Omnipotent, had to learn his lessons 4 times. How much more so an ordinary pupil who learns from an ordinary teacher? So this gives us a little bit more detail, Dana, to your point about how, you know, the transmission actually went about going on. Now, what this does in terms of a rabbinic authority, you put these two together, right? The implications are that the rabbinic system, or at least the ones in the Talmud, are following a chain of tradition from, you know, all the way up from generations, from Moses to the Omnipotent, right? So ultimately, the authority is derived not from, you know, so much a special status, not from something innate, but you are, in fact, continuing the exact same teaching that God had initially began at Har Sinai. So that's one basis for rabbinic authority, which is you are continuing this tradition. Yes?
My basic problem for the whole course is when you observe something or don't observe something, and I say why, there are two answers you can give. One is because it was in fact the word of God. He whispered it to Moses, and Moses whispered it to Aaron, and so on. The other is, actually, God doesn't care which way I go on this, but he told me to do whatever those guys say to do.
Yes. And that will apply also to the development of the halachic system. Meaning, people have certain authority, right? You know, let's say the rabbis, you know, wherever they derive their authority, we'll give 2 other explanations today, and we'll spend a lot of time expanding on those over, you know, subsequent weeks. Once rabbis have certain authority, you can also change the process in terms of how things can develop, right? So let's say initially it was just pure transmissions, like you have this, you have this. So one thing is, well, the only thing that you can do is transmit exactly what was given before you. But you also have gezeirot and takanot. Right, and there is some room for innovation, for coming up with new laws as time demands, for new interpretations as, you know, the needs arise or as people come up with things. And we'll talk a little bit more about this component as well. I mean, the question is a good question. It just, you know, we're doing almost Roshei Prakim. We're doing almost like 3 different models that we can spend several weeks on any one of these and how they're addressed in the Gemara. Right, so like there's there's several Gemaras that discuss about flaws in transmission, right? So, well, I shouldn't say right, but there are, and we can spend time discussing those. But ultimately, like if you say, well, ultimately the authority comes from Moshe from Sinai, well, then that at least gives you some degree of authority to set up any future judicial procedure. So, like, the only analogy I can have is, say, American law. However, you know, the rights of, like, social contractors setting up a constitution to begin with, that aside, we have a Congress. Congress can change the rules, right, through an act of legislation because, you know, like, let's say, filibuster, right? You didn't change rules for filibuster. You can say, well, we're going to require for our own internal body a supermajority or to be a simple majority. Congress has a right to make up whatever rules that they want. And yes, there's a certain degree of checks and balances with the Supreme Court. You can also change the Constitution, because the Constitution provides rules for how to go about changing the Constitution. Did that help answer your question at all? Slightly. Mm. It might take a few more months before you're going
to
get a satisfactory
answer. Yeah.
So that's one. So one approach is, again, the source for rabbinic authority is continuing the divine transmission. The other is divine sanction. And here's the Gemara that might have to revisit a few times. The Gemara about Tanur Shelach Nai from Bava Metzia 59b, run through quickly. On that day, Rabbi Eliezer brought forth every imaginable argument, but they did not accept them. Said he to them, "If the halacha agrees with me, let this carob tree prove it." Thereupon, the carob tree was torn 100 cubits out of its place. Others affirmed 400 cubits. "No proof can be brought from a carob tree," they retorted. Again, he said to them, "If the halacha agrees with me, let the stream of water prove it." Whereupon the stream of water flowed backwards. "No proof can be brought from a stream of water," they rejoined. Again, he urged, "If the halacha agrees with me, let the walls of the schoolhouse prove it." Thereupon the walls inclined to fall. But Joshua, Rabbi Joshua rebuked them, saying, "When the scholars are engaged in a halachic dispute, what have you to interfere?" Hence, they did not fall in honor of Joshua, nor did they resume upright in honor of Rabbi Eliezer. They are still standing thus inclined. Again, he said to them, "If Allah agrees with me, let it be proved from heaven." Whereupon a heavenly voice cried out, "Why do you dispute with Rabbi Eliezer, seeing that in all matters Allah agrees with him?" Rabbi Joshua rose and exclaimed, "It is not in heaven." What did he mean by this? Said Rabbi Yirmiyah, "The Torah had already been given at Mount Sinai. We pay no attention to a heavenly voice, because you have long since written in the Torah at Mount Sinai, after the majority, one must incline." Acharei Rabim Lahatot. And, you know, continues, Rav Natan made Eliyahu, "What does the Holy One, blessed be He, do in that hour?" He laughed with joy, saying, "My sons have defeated me, my sons have defeated me." Short version here. I mean, this is an incredibly rich passage, and people love spending hours on this one. Bekitzor, the point here, at least, is whence do rabbis derive their authority? The answer is simply God. That the Torah itself, on, you know, following the majority, Acharei Rabim Lahatot, following Sarli Bet Lo Yisri Amin Usmol, do not deviate from the left or to the right, God is already giving authority to these individuals to come up with their own decision. Right? Now, so let's say it's, you know, the Kohanim, Halevim, and the Shofet here be Amimahim. What authority, what right do they have to judge? The answer is divine sanction. God gave them that right. When did God give them that right? In the Torah. Now, a question you could ask, like as it gets extended further, is who do you know which how do you know which individuals are the ones who have that proper sanction? And that, you know, perhaps we're going to have to combine, you know, two different things, and we'll explain, you know, also worthwhile, that'll take some time to explain over time. But the second reason why you have a Jewish court system where it has any basis in Jewish law is simply because God says so and God permits it, which means that halacha, even though it might be run by, you know, Jews, isn't, or at least by individuals, is not a purely social construct. It's one that was given divine sanction to. Yeah.
Okay. Why does he invoke after the majority was one must incline?
Yeah.
When the pasuk says,
not l'rav. Yeah.
Losa na'arav lintos acharei rabim latos. Specifically, don't follow the majority.
Well, for bad.
Is there another instance of the phrase acharei rabim lahatos?
Not that I know, but read the whole verse and, you know, read the English translation there.
Hang on. Where is this? 30? No, I'm sorry. 2. Do not respond to a grievance by yielding to the majority to pervert the law.
To pervert the law. Meaning, you don't follow. The problem with following the majority in that pasuk isn't that, you know, majority mob rule, but rather it's the problem is by way of perversion. Could there have been better pasukim that he could have quoted? Sure. Why did he quote majority here? Because to show, I think, that in an act of legislation, right, you go by majority, and assuming that that's your real due process, it's not just, and or look at it this way, you know, at this point, if you don't necessarily have that same, you know, position of authority, you're not in that makom asher yivchar, you don't really have that, you know, that biblically defined body set up, right, so you're dealing with, you know, there, it doesn't seem to be that they're actually having this debate in the Beis HaMikdash or by the Beis HaMikdash, right? So what are you going to refer to? You're going to say, well, you gave us some idea of majority rule, in which case we, as the majority, are making a decision. Yes.
Okay, so kind of to extend that a little bit, is it true that if the Sanhedrin unanimously voted to put someone to death, that he got acquitted?
We'll get to, yes, we'll get to that in, as far as, no. Yeah, George.
Yeah, this is from the Bavli. The Yushalami just describes it a little bit differently.
Yeah. Yeah, again, there's a lot more to do here. The point of citing this here is to give what are, again, are just the basis, again, for rabbinic authority. And here, how are they appealing to it? They're appealing to the Bible and the permission they got. Did you have a question, Ed?
Yeah, this heavenly voice.
Yeah.
So that doesn't count. But the giving of the Ten Commandments and passage in the Torah, that's supposed to be from a heavenly voice.
Yeah.
So why not throw that one out, too?
So that is an interesting question, especially since a bat kol does come into play in terms of adjudicating between Beit Hillel and Shammai. I think it would be this. Once you have your initial revelation, right, God gives you the Torah, which again we're going to assume the Torah is representative of divine will, then you follow the rules that are in the Torah. And once you have that revelation down, well then you follow the procedures that were, you know, embedded in there. Right? And I think that's the exact argument. Yeah, so God, you know, gives us the Torah, but then once he gives us the right and the authority to interpret and to make enactments, then it's almost like we're assuming a degree of responsibility over it. And to take it a step further, I was talking to George about this yesterday, you've got a really crucial distinction here in terms of an approach to authority, which is really contrasted in the next section. When you rely on a bat kol, right, you're kind of relying on continuous revelation as the source of your authority. Now, who gets revelation? Not a whole lot of people. I mean, people think that they do, but, you know, one of the things that the Torah, you know, that people like saying about the Torah is that it was a very public revelation, at least as described in the Torah. How many people in history said, God spoke to me and only me, saying blah, 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 and whatever that is? A lot of people do that.
Son of Sam.
You, not just Son of Sam, you also have many major religions that follow, and not just major religions, quite a few minor religions of people doing that. And, you know, could easily be open to manipulation. When you have, I mean, following also on your point, and after the majority, how do you know it's a majority? Everything is handled in public. There's a certain degree of transparency behind it, right? If you're just going to rely on a bat kol, then that's going to be selective revelation. And saying, well, I happen to have, you know, a secret authority behind it. Now, that's actually the opinion in this last case here, which you've got Ramban on Lo Yasri Aminu Smol, right? And he's writing, lived in Spain, 1294, and died in Israel, 1270. Even if it appears to you that the sages confuse the right with the left, and certainly if it appears to you that what they call right is that what they call right is in fact right, for the Spirit of God rests upon his holy servants, and they will forever be protected from mistakes and stumbling. So according to Ramban, rabbinic authority is buttressed by divine intervention.
You think you say the same thing today?
Well, here's what I found. You know, predated by almost a millennia, you have Tertullian, one of the early church fathers, wrote, "For the church is properly and primarily the Spirit, in whom the Trinity of the one divinity, the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, the Spirit makes the assembly of the church, which the Lord established in three persons. And thus the whole number of those who have leagued together in this faith is given the status of the church by the church's author and consecrator. For the right of judgments belongs to the Lord, not to the servant, to God himself, not to the priest." Point being here, he's giving effectively the exact same argument that Ramban is going to give generations later. That rabbis aren't in fact making the law, but rather the Spirit of Heaven rests among them. Actually very proud of this little point, because this got me a footnote in a couple of Chacham Fa'ur's books. So if you've ever seen the movie Footnote, this is mine for having come up with this. I wrote this actually on a paper in Ramban, which really, really ticked off the professor. But I put this here because today, certainly when people talk colloquially and conventionally, we'll give this argument or something similar, that rabbis have a certain rabbis, you know, if not every rabbi Gedolim, in a certain level, and we've got a whole class on that too, okay. have a special, unique relationship because they're not Jewish thing. They're not just giving rulings because of their seichel, because of their intellect, because of any judicial process, but because they can somehow intuit the will of God. They're imbued with a certain Ruach HaKodesh. And this is a point which is also itself going to require some extrapolation, even from the rabbinic sources, where they are very emphatic about saying a chacham is adif min navi, that a sage is greater than a prophet. But yes, this idea not only contradicts the idea from the Gemara in Bava Metzia in 59b, where even an explicit revelation that other people can hear doesn't count. You could say Kal v'chomer, an implicit one. But it's also, you know, I think more representative of a, you know, Christian or Catholic approach to law. And this Arjun Rabban's statement, to my knowledge, appears absolutely nowhere in rabbinic law. It does appear in an early church father, so take that as you wish. But people will still use this argument today. To say that Gedolim are right because they have some sort of Ruach HaKodesh that prevents them from making mistakes. And we actually, I think, did a letter recently where a well-known rabbi pretty much referenced this particular Ramban, and he continued saying that, you know, if you question this rabbi, it's as if you're questioning every single Beit Din since Moshe Rabbeinu, but in the process of this letter, he in fact was questioning another Beis Din because this rabbi said something different. Yeah. Anyway, George.
Yeah. But we had a discussion yesterday about the voice from heaven coming down saying that Eliezer is correct.
Yeah.
Right. So now, how are they, if the Spirit of God rests on their shoulders and that they're being protected from making mistakes? If Eliezer was correct in his decision, then the group of rabbis are mistaken.
Yeah, you know, I'd have to look up the Ramban on the Gemara. See what he says there. I'd have to check.
You understand?
Yeah. No, it's a great question. Now, I would argue, and, you know, so this at least gives us a few different models about how to, you know, view rabbinic authority, right? Two of them go back to the Bible itself, right? One by way of, you could say that the thing of transmission is kind of like the model that Moshe set up, either by Yitro or by his own impetus, depending on which version you read. That's one. Another is explicit divine sanction. And a third is continuous revelation. I would argue that the first two are going to figure much more prominently in rabbinic literature. By rabbinic literature, I mean, you know, the Talmud and the stuff that we have. The latter one, not so much. You know, it serves a certain rhetorical purpose. I don't think that, you know, Chazal set that up. But for the, you know, subsequent weeks, we're going to try to go through at least the rabbinic sources and to see, well, how other ways did they explain their own authority? What did they have to say about their own authority? And how did they develop the halachic method? And where we're going to go with that is effectively saying, if you assume the authority of the Talmud, then what were the rules that the Talmud themselves set up, right? Because what we're going to see is that, you know, practically people selectively follow the Talmud, right? You know, because the Talmud doesn't just have a whole bunch of laws. It also has a system for how laws are supposed to evolve and develop. And those are going to be very important questions that will continue with questions of authority. So I think next week we will start talking about who exactly is a rabbi, because, you know, if people are going to be making certain statements, well, who has, you know, certain rights to do stuff. All right. So hope to see y'all next week. Yeah.